Blog Talk Radio.
This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, on Sunday, October the 21st. As we like to do on Sundays, we'll be chatting with our friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. Another exciting week in the presidency of Donald Trump. Lots of things to get into. We'll look at Beto down here in Texas. Looks like Texas is in the news quite a bit. I mean, you read quite a bit about Texas, not just about Beto, but there's now accusations of illegal immigrants being signed up to vote. There's even a lawsuit against the Beto campaign because apparently they're sending out unsolicited text messages. I don't think that's going to get very far, but anyway, it's interesting how everybody is just talking Texas these days. The midterms are coming up. We've got one more show to do before the midterms, and right now I have no idea what's going to happen. I feel very confident about the Republicans in the U.S. Senate, but I have to tell you that I really don't know what's going to happen in the House because I see conflicting information really about what could actually happen. Very difficult situation happening in the country. We'll get into this as well, where you have politicians being confronted by people. I'm just worried somebody's going to get hurt very badly one of these days, and then we're going to remember. There's now talk of Hillary Clinton running in 2020. Not exactly sure why, but she's out there talking about this. Other people are talking about it. Vice President Biden is also talking about running. While all this is going on, the American economy continues to do rather well. There is a caravan coming from Guatemala to the United States. It looks like they were stopped on the Mexico-Guatemala border. And right now, I'm not exactly sure how many of them are coming north. I know some are being sent back. I don't think Mexico is really interested in promoting these kinds of caravans. Some news this week about the United States and Russia on a nuclear treaty deal that we may be backing out of. And, of course, the situation in Saudi Arabia, extremely sensitive situation in Saudi Arabia. So there you have it, Bill. I think we've got enough to talk about. What do you think, my friend?
Well, I guess so. Now, you know, maybe when we talk about it, we can talk about it with at least twice or three times or four times the depth of what we're seeing on television. You know, you go through a campaign, you have all these news operations. Do they ever talk about issues? Do they ever talk about the state of the nation? It's all reported like a horse race. And, of course, we know what side or what horse the press is rooting for. And it just seems to be that the election is just kind of who wins and that's all. What happens mm-hmm. to the country? Well, we don't really care. I mean, after all, that's boring stuff. We have to read about that. But it's you know, I was watching a few days ago. It was very interesting. I went on to YouTube, and there is a report, a film, of a 1955 panel of CBS news correspondents. Every year, CBS in those days would bring back its foreign correspondents from around the world, and they'd have a roundtable discussion. And this was actually radio. They filmed it, but mm-hmm. they didn't film it. Maybe it was just a series of stills. But you could hear them talking about what was going on in the individual areas of the world that they covered. And the level was so much higher than it is today. They took this mm-hmm. seriously. A news story right. wasn't just an image. It wasn't just a game. It wasn't just how can the reporter advance his career. I mean, now, of mm-hmm. course, these were men who had covered World War II directly. They had seen mm-hmm. horror with their own eyes, not just read about it or seen it in a TV movie. And they took their work very, very seriously. That doesn't mean they were always right. But to see the come down. Now, in those days, a news program on television in the evening was 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And they did more in 15 minutes than some of these people do in 24 hours. I mean, now, one of the reasons is, you know, and this is something we never really like to discuss in this country, was the fact that if you go back to that era, 1955, it was only 10 years after the end of World War II. And you had
mm-hmm.
millions of Americans who were in their 20s, late 20s, who had fought in that war. And they
mm-hmm.
took the news seriously. They knew what it could lead to. And what you have today is this kind of flaky, kind of, you know, shallow journalism based on shallow candidates. My goodness, did you hear the latest from Evita in the Bronx?
I think you wrote about this, didn't
yes.
you? Did you write about this? She's just absolutely... I mean, she's, you know, there are times when she's just crazy, Bill, when she's talking
yes.
about the economy. But when she starts comparing global warming to Nazi Germany, that
yes.
that is not just stupid. But I have to believe that's an insult to anybody who had a relative in concentration camps.
Yes.
That's how
or
I would. If
fought in the war.
Exactly.
The war.
I mean, you still have many men alive who fought in that war. And to hear this young woman make that comparison, it's just absolutely insane, Bill.
Well, she's a child. I mean, she's not stupid, by the way. She actually graduated fourth in her class at Boston University. But she's a child. She sees things from a childlike perspective. She said we had global warming is a threat to our existence, just as we had a threat to our existence from Nazism around World War II. Around World War II? What
right.
year is she talking about? Does
That's
she
right,
know,
yeah.
Does she even know when
Hello?
World War II was fought? But she's a
right.
product of an educational system, and she's a product of a journalism system that has made her into a national celebrity, even though she has absolutely nothing to say.
That's it. She really doesn't. I mean, when you listen to her, and not just her, but if you listen to some of these other Democrats who are running, then you have the young man down in Florida, you know, the gun control for young man
who said
something today, I'm paraphrasing, but he said something today along the lines of that the people coming in these caravans, they need to be led into the country because all of this land, I guess, was stolen from somebody. I don't know who stole it from who. I didn't know that the people who lived in Guatemala had Texas stolen from them, but nevertheless, that's I mean, they're full of all of these cliches and all of this stuff that you just want to grab them and put them down and maybe the point you made, Bill, if I may go back to it for a second, if you had been a reporter in World War II and you had seen the devastation in some of those European cities, or if you had lived in London during the bombing, or if you had been to Hiroshima or whatever, you really saw devastation. I mean, you were really given a contrast between good and evil. But a lot of these young people, I hate to say it, they don't have a clue, Bill. And their education system is no better, Bill.
Well, I'm afraid they don't have a clue. You know, I have a friend who's a distinguished actress. We were discussing the subject recently, and I said, what's wrong with this generation? The millennial generation. And she said something very, I think, very profound. She said, they've never seen strife, actual
mm-hmm.
strife. They've never seen it in their own lives. They may
right.
read about it. They may see some TV films. But they've never actually seen it. For goodness sake, when I was growing up in this country, I mean, everybody knew a soldier. We could walk down the block where I lived on Long Island, and there was a fellow who had been hit by a mortar shell and walked with a limp. His next-door neighbor had been a tail gunner on a B-17. Next to him lived a woman whose brother was a merchant ship captain who was torpedoed and sunk twice. Further down the block was a refugee from Nazi Germany. Then there was a guy who got called up again in Korea. That's what we saw.
Mm-hmm.
We were connected to events, and of course you always knew the families that had casualties. These kids today are a mediocre generation and they are the children of a mediocre generation. Ever since the 60s, the late 60s, not the early 60s, standards have slipped in this country. Then
mm-hmm.
the 70s, they call the 70s the me generation. Well, of course,
mm-hmm.
when you follow the 60s generation, which lowered standards in every area, you're going to get the me generation. And there may have been a pause for a while, but beginning in the 80s, we started getting warnings from good educators about the closing of the American mind, the mediocrity that was taking over American education, schools of education controlled by Marxists, and we are seeing the culmination of that today. I remember going to a meeting in 2003, because I was working on a television program, and one of the participants, who was a very distinguished civil rights lawyer, was saying that our college students were not being taught anything about human freedom, about freedom of speech. And he said, these are going to be your leaders in 20 years. And it's even less than 20 now, it's about 15. But we're already beginning to see them emerging as leaders. And what we're seeing is pretty frightening. I mean, many of them are just, they go on to these college campuses having graduated from high schools that are dominated today by schools of education that are very left-wing. And they go into college, and the very first thing they do is they find themselves separated by ethnic group. You're not an American anymore. You're a hyphenated American. And a certain number come to believe this stuff.
Right. And they believe so many bad things about the United States.
Bill. Oh, absolutely. Well, that's what they're taught.
Because they're basically, for example, slavery. Nobody has ever told them that slavery, it's almost as if, you know, they're being taught that slavery was invented in the United States.
Yes.
Or that, you know, discrimination was invented in the United States. They don't put this in any kind of international or historical perspective, you know. So all they hear is all the bad things about the United States. But then you have, Bill, some utterly irresponsible, I mean, it's just utterly irresponsible Democrats. This lady who's running for governor in Georgia recently said, whatever her name is, but she's running for governor in California, in Georgia. I mean, she basically said that, you know, illegal immigrants are part of the blue wave. I mean, that's the kind of thing that anybody had said that 20 years ago, they would have been almost ridiculed. They would have been basically forced to resign from the ticket, I would think.
That's right. Well,
but here,
well,
you know, here
yeah.
she is. She's not only be, she's. I mean, my gosh, people are saying, well, of course, illegal immigrants are part of the blue wave. They're being discriminated against. Oh, really? Amazing. Just amazing.
Yes, and also it was pointed out immediately to her that illegal immigrants can't vote. How can they be part of the blue wave? You know, but the little details like that escape them. And, of course, in Florida, you have a man running for governor who will probably win in 2 weeks, who is the mayor of the city in Florida with the highest crime rate in the state, who is anti-law enforcement. And what are these voters thinking when they vote in a man? Well, we know what they're thinking. These are races that are based largely on race, on ethnicity. Mm-hmm. You know, you go and you vote for the person whose race you like. Well, that's a terrible way of electing anybody. It really is. And I don't know if it's going to work permanently. Maybe there'll be a backlash against it. One of the most interesting things, and you could comment on that, on this with some knowledge, is that the Democrats are very worried about the Hispanic vote, and I think you made the comment on one of the programs a few weeks ago that there is a generation of young Hispanics who are very entrepreneurial, and they're not going to buy into this stuff.
No, they're not. I think there's also a history in certain Hispanic groups, particularly Mexicans, of not showing up to vote, and that's part of the problem. I think that they're having that. They may register people, but they may not get them out to vote. I just don't think they have much of a message either for some of these young Hispanics who are coming out of school or setting up their own shop. I mean, look, if you're running a tire shop somewhere in Dallas or where else, you understand about taxes. You understand about Obamacare. You don't have to have an MBA to understand any of this. You look at the economy and say the economy is doing fairly well right now. That's easy to see. Regardless of who you are. I just think that some of these – now, what's happening in Florida, I'm not up to speed on that. I know this gentleman, the Democrat, appears to be ahead in some of these polls, but I also see that Nelson is apparently ahead in his race, so I don't know. But the key to the Democrats this year, Bill, is turnout. They have got to get the turnout. If they get turnout, then there are going to be some victories, like potentially in Florida. But it's all about turnout, and maybe in the next time we do our show, next Sunday, when we have access to some of the early voting numbers and some of the trends, because as I understand, they haven't really registered that as many people as they thought they were supposed to bill.
Well, that's true. And also, I just wonder what is going on in the minds of many people. You know, I think we've spoken about this before. The Hispanic vote is not monolithic.
Right, exactly.
Hispanics are not one group. There are many different cultures within it, and they may think mm-hmm. very different things. I would love to know, for example, what many Cuban Americans think about this, quote, migration or this the migrant march coming up
mm-hmm.
into California or trying to reach the American border from Honduras and some of the other countries in Latin America, Guatemala. I mean, it's so obvious that this is organized. And it's organized
right.
to break right before the election, so that Trump can be made to appear to be the ogre,
bad guy.
And the bad guy, and they will try to influence the Hispanic vote that way. I mean, this is you know, I don't believe in coincidences, and this
no.
is not a
well,
coincidence.
Let me tell you how I answered that question recently, because I was asked that question by because one of the things that we Cubans are often confronted. We Cuban-Americans, I should say, we're often confronted with that question or that point. We're told, well, you guys had special privileges when you came here. And, you know, you had special situation when you came here. And I always say to them, well, it's not really special. First of all, it was legal. It was approved by the Congress. And it was a way of helping Cubans come to the United States. But, I mean, most of us paid back the United States many times with how we did and the work that we did and so on. But also, none of us, I don't remember 4,000 Cubans showing up on boats at any particular time. Now, there was that Mariel boat
lift,
but that
yeah.
was actually an isolated case, because if you look at the million-plus Cubans or so who've come, we all came in a very orderly fashion, as our family did and other families did, meaning we had to come in, we had to be screened. You know, we had to go through a certain amount of process. Even the Freedom flights of people coming every day, you would get to the airport, but you had to get permission in Cuba to get on the flights. So it wasn't like just people jumping on a caravan and coming to the United States. It was a little bit more conditional than that. But they always bring that up, that we Cubans had special advantages, and that's not really true.
Of course not.
Had to go through a lot of screening to get here. And this idea of just showing up on the border and saying, hey, you know, we want to come in. Well, you cannot do that. First of all, you don't know who these people are. They need to be checked. We had to go through health exams before we came to the United States, Bill. I mean, we had, you know, they checked us out from a health standpoint, because you don't want to bring in 4,000 people you don't know anything about. I mean, they could be bringing all kinds of health problems, whether they know it or don't know it. It doesn't matter. It has the same effect once you get here. So I don't think that this caravan has as much support with the Hispanic community as you would think, Bill. I think there's a lot of Hispanics who understand that immigration has to be orderly. Yes, they favor, as I do, I favor legal immigration, but it has to be in an orderly way, Bill.
Yes, I think that's true. And after all, the great majority of Hispanics who've come to this country have come through the system,
sure.
you did, and your family did, and I didn't. I'm not Hispanic, but they went through the immigration procedure. And
mm-hmm.
another thing is this, you use an interesting word that is now becoming very popular on the left, privilege. Isn't that interesting? Have you ever noticed the fact, Silvio, that the left, the thing the left hates most of all is success. Anybody,
right.
any country, any group that succeeds, there must be a suspicious story about it. You know, there must be something, some privilege they had. The idea of working hard, keeping your family together, seeking education, real education, doesn't
mm-hmm.
seem to impress them at all. But, I mean, if you look at the groups that are now beginning to get static in America, the successful groups, especially in universities, they're the ones facing the most opposition. And on the left, I mean, this is you may remember about 10 years ago, the
mm-hmm.
Democrats started this business that corporations don't create jobs, only the government
mm-hmm.
creates jobs. And Hillary
right.
Clinton went around and said that you didn't create these jobs. Well, for goodness sake, how many stories have we read about people who founded great industries, great corporations, who worked day and night building these companies? That doesn't mean all of them, of course, but who invented the computer industry. Who do they really believe the government did that? I don't think
right.
so. I mean, mm-hmm. why don't we put government bureaucrats on a statue? You know, we don't do it. It's other people we do. But it is really amazing that the politics of resentment, that if somebody succeeds, they must be resented because they must have cheated.
Right.
It's just phenomenal to hear that.
Well, of course, we get that, Bill. We Cuban Americans, we get that all the time because we're called white Cubans.
Yeah.
That's what they call us, white Cubans. You guys are white Cubans. Okay, so what does that mean? White Mexicans are different? Well, no, but you guys
yeah.
are white Cubans and white Venezuelans or white Argentinians. I mean, what's the big difference? And, of course, when they talk about privilege, I always remind them that my father, who rest in peace, my father worked as a at a hotel carrying bags through the rooms. I guess a bellboy.
Right.
I guess that's what they call it.
Bellhop. Yeah.
He worked. He did that job for 4 years. I don't know. I don't remember anybody. I don't remember him coming here saying, "Well, you know, I have the privilege of doing this or that." No, he had to really get his way back into banking, and he did it by doing a lot of hard work and working many nights and many weekends. You know, many Sunday afternoons, Saturday afternoons, we would see him leave for the hotel and not get back home until like 1 or 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning because obviously those were busy nights. At the hotel. So I don't, you know, anybody wants to talk about privilege, they're not going to get very far with me because my other uncle picked tomatoes in Florida for a while when he got here. So, you know, I don't want to hear all this stuff about privilege because everything we got, we earned, Bill.
That's exactly right. You know, I've said many times that many of our grandparents would give anything to live the lives that minorities live in America today.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they had there were no benefits, there were no welfare programs, there wasn't even unemployment insurance. Many of them came to this country not only penniless, but in voyages that affected their health for the rest of their lives. You hear these stories of immigrants, and they're true, and you hear family stories, and they're true. Some of them would have to break up their families. One would come, and then another would bring the other to the United States, and they're called privileged. They're called privileged, and they're often called privileged by people who today who have full scholarships to Ivy League schools,
mm-hmm.
and have all kinds of programs waiting for them, and then they call themselves marginalized. Well, they're not marginalized; they're actually privileged.
Right, and certainly have a lot of opportunities that my parents didn't have, and that others didn't have. Now, my parents never complained about anything. My parents, you know, saw. That, you know, so coming here and starting at the bottom, they saw that as the opportunity that, or the price they had to pay to live in a free country. They never complained about anything. But I think some of these, like you say, I think a lot of our educational system is really messed up. And we are graduating young men and young women from universities who are really very unprepared for the world, not just from a education standpoint, but even mentally. I don't think they understand how difficult the world is. And I think a lot of them are in for some very, very unpleasant surprises. You mentioned the caravan, Bill, and of course, that is one of the ads that Senator Cruz is running down here. He's being called a racist, of course, for doing this. But Senator Cruz is basically saying, how can you let 4,000 people into the country? You know, how can we run the? I mean, I'm paraphrasing his ad, but he's basically saying, how can you run the risk of bringing people who could be terrorists, who could have health problems? And of course, he's immediately called a racist.
Well, of course, that's the only, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's the only thing they know how to do. I mean, what is so wrong about saying that you want to check people before they come to the country? I mean, people check. If I went to get a job anywhere, they would check me out. So isn't that true with the country, Bill?
Well, you know, this is the thing, Sylvia. When you don't have a platform to run on, when you don't
right.
have any real ideas, this is what you do. You just start attacking, and this is the modern McCarthyism that we see today. It's the McCarthyism we saw at the Kavanaugh hearings. Don Lemon
mm-hmm.
was on TV denying it. Oh, no, this is not McCarthyism. This is a search for the truth. Oh, right. I mean, I'm sure it
right,
was.
Right.
The, you know, it's sexist, racist, anti-gay, the chants that they do. And now they're getting into people's faces physically, and as you've said, there's a great danger of something terrible happening. But they believe that they have been convinced that they are the oppressed people. And what is amazing to me is to also hear that this is beginning to affect white suburban women. I mean, for goodness sake, of all the privileged people in the United States, well, you know, people say, well, maybe we are privileged, but we now have to help our other citizens. Well, I have no problem with that at all, but if the help should be real help that actually leads them and helps them to live a better life, not just to be a one-time payment, which is going to be dissipated. I'm sure you've noticed, by the way, that the new there is one idea that is rising and bubbling to the top in liberal democratic circles, and that is this idea of a guaranteed income, where each person would be guaranteed a certain amount of money. And I think was it Maxine Waters or maybe it was Kamala Harris who said $500 a month, which will get you nowhere. And and how will we pay for it? We'll cancel the tax cut that President Trump enacted. Well, I don't know. Look, there may be many people in America who go for that.
Maybe more than we realize, because this message of envy and class warfare is connecting with people, and that's why I think this particular election is so important, Bill. Let me take a little break, and then we'll come back with more from our friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. I want you to hear from my friend Carlos Guedes, who's been playing around Dallas these days.
This is Carlos Guedes Harpies. I would like to see you guys this Saturday night at Tzatziki's at the Star, located at 6765 Winning Drive in Frisco. I'll be performing instrumental high-energy music at 6:30 until 9:30 p.m. Make your reservation today at 972-377-2276. Remember, Tzatziki's at the Star is the place to hang out on Saturday night. For upcoming dates, look for me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
And we have a link to Carlos' website on the show information right under the description of the show. You'll see a link to his website. And we've also added another friend to our show, and that's my good friend Duke Machado, who's a car dealer down in Central Texas. You know, something I'm learning about the car business these days is that, you know, you can get a car anywhere in the country. I mean, you just order a car, I guess, and they'll drive it to you. And my friend Duke Machado down in Central Texas does stuff like that. So click on his link, if you're looking for a car. And Duke has promised me that if you tell him that I gave you the name, that he's going to treat you even better than he normally treats people. So anyway, he's a great guy. He's a great guy, Duke Machado. Well, let's get back to another great guy, and that's Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. Bill, I wanted to touch a little bit on Texas, because we seem to be so much in the news these days. Not only is Beto in the news every day, I mean, he's getting money from everywhere in the country. He doesn't seem to get a lot from Texas, but he sure gets from a lot of other places. And many people are reminded of Wendy Davis in 2014. But there's a couple of issues here in Texas. Illegal immigration is one of them. Accusations that the Democrats are, in fact, playing around with signing illegal immigrants to vote. I haven't really seen any evidence yet other than the accusation. Some people have come under scrutiny. But this could be very serious, because I could see the Democrats, not necessarily here in Texas, but doing it in California, Bill, where there's a lot of representatives up for re-election, Bill.
Well, of course. And you know, you've got a Democratic Party now that is really basing part of its future on illegal immigrants. I mean, they see the numbers growing, especially in places like California. California is a disaster area. It really is. This used to be the Golden State. That's what its title, its nickname is. And I remember the years when Ronald Reagan was governor and others, including Democrats, and the state really was a national leader. Now, with the exception of the strip along the ocean, which is where the, you know, quote, the rich people live, in the Silicon Valley and the great universities and all the rest. With the exception of that, California is becoming really one of the worst places in America to live. The taxes are ridiculously high. the place is becoming riddled with crime. San Francisco, apparently one of the most beautiful cities in America, is becoming an impossible place to visit because of the conditions, even the stench in the streets. And yet this is considered progressivism. We're progressive. We welcome people here. Well, they can welcome. And by the way, the educational system is one of the worst in the country. It used to be the best. There also used to be a time when California was a state known for building airplanes, large manufacturing industries. They're all gone. Many people are leaving California in the middle class. And they just don't care. The establishment in California just doesn't care. I think they like a country or like a state that is composed of rich and poor and nobody in between. I think
Exactly. But see, I think what we're seeing there, and you know, I lived in Mexico City for 4 years, related to my work. And one of the and you kind of saw this in Mexico City, where the well-to-do needed the poor to do a bunch of things they couldn't find anybody else to do. So it was the poor who worked as maids. It was the poor who cut the grass. It was the poor who would wash your car. In every building, every office building, there was a person down in the garage who would wash your car, shine your shoes. I mean, that's basically what it was like. I mean, you basically had two societies, the well-to-do and the not well-to-do. And that's kind of the way California is turning out. I was talking to a friend out there who told me that in California you need illegal immigration, because if you don't have illegal immigration, they can't get anybody to cut your grass. They don't have anybody. I mean, it's really sad. But, I mean, when I was growing up, high school kids used to cut grass. I guess that doesn't work in California anymore, Bill.
No, I cut grass. I did that. Actually, I cut grass for the principal of our high school. I thought it was an admirable thing to do for a summer.
Sure.
And made a little extra money. Yes, that's very, very true. I mean, you have the upper class, the elites, and then you have the servant class, and they don't like the people in between. The people who form small businesses, who run stores, they are the people that the upper classes like to look down on. The people in the lower classes, they look down on them as well, but they, as you said, they need them. So they become, in effect, part of the family of those who keep the establishment going. It's a terrible, terrible development in American life, because the country really does depend on its middle class, and that middle class is shrinking. And what is also shrinking in America is the commitment to freedom, and that is something that I don't think people want to talk about. The news media won't talk about it because they don't have any interest in it. They don't have an interest in most things. One of the things that really strikes me in watching news programs is you get the feeling that many of the people on the air don't have a particular interest in the subjects that they're reporting. They really don't want to go beyond the surface level. And that's very, very sad, because you have to go beyond the surface level. They're poorly educated because they've come out of American universities during a very bad time and those universities' history. And I think we are a country that is building problems, and I don't know what the future is going to be. You know, one of the things that I think we have to be very careful about in this country is the possibility that some people who really are intelligent and mature and accomplished will get fed up and leave. Now, that's not something you associate with the United States. We associate the United States with people coming and wanting to be Americans. But in fact, for a few years during the Depression, we were an out-migration country. More people left than came because of economic conditions. This can happen again, not only because of economic conditions, but it can happen because of social conditions. If people feel they're not respected and not wanted, and no matter how hard they work, they'll get nowhere because they're not the member of this year's chosen group, then they might simply decide to leave. And I think that's a frightening prospect, but it might happen.
That's right. Well, let's talk a little bit about these midterms. I mentioned in the introduction that I feel confident about the U.S. Senate. I think I'm confident that the Republicans will have a net 3 at the end of the night, maybe more, but I'll just say 3 just to be safe. The House is up in the air. I really don't know what to say. I read things that say the Republicans are back. I read other things that say, no, the Democrats are going to win. So I really don't know. It all kind of comes down to turnout. The good news on turnout is the Republicans are, in fact, turning out. And I'll have a much better feeling for this, Bill, next week when we chat, because early voting begins Monday the 22nd, and I can generally get a sense of turnout on the early voting when you see the lines. And so I'll have a better feel. But I get the feeling that there's a lot of Republicans who are going to turn out. President Trump is going to be here on Monday
tomorrow.
In Houston.
Yeah.
There's 70,000 people.
Tomorrow is the 22nd.
Yes, there's 70,000 people who have tickets or want to go see him. They don't even know where they don't have a place big enough to put him. You know, where's the Astrodome when we really need it? I mean, it's really amazing. 70,000 people. That's a lot of people, Bill. So that tells me there's some energy there, which makes me feel a little bit better about the Republicans at least holding on to the House, Bill.
Well, you know, I quoted on Urgent Agenda today a line from William Goldman, the screenwriter, who was writing about Hollywood, and he says, "Nobody knows anything." And I think we're in that situation now. It's very hard to poll midterm elections because there's no one unifying factor as there is in the presidential year where you have the presidential ballot. So you're talking about individual state elections for individual people. The polling is not held as often as it is during a presidential year. So you might get a poll in one Senate race 1 week and wait 3 weeks for the next poll in that mm-hmm. same race. Now, obviously, the candidates are doing internal polling. That they do. But it is very hard to know because, first of all, you've got to poll likely voters, and that means identifying likely voters. Your polling organization has to be honest. It has to ask the right questions. We have a poll today, for example, showing Bill Nelson, the incumbent Democratic senator from Florida, up 5 points. But all the polls in the last few weeks in Florida have shown either a dead heat or Governor Scott, who is an excellent governor, up a few points over Nelson. So who knows what's actually happening?
Right.
It's very,
well, that's
very
it.
Hard to know.
That's exactly right. It's very hard to know just what. Now, I was listening to a program the other day, and they were talking about the Washington Post poll that came out this week. And that's the poll that said the Democrats were going to win the House. We had a big lead in the generic, but the 50 districts that would decide the election, the Republicans were plus one. Kind of an interesting.
Yes.
Way to look at it. But one of the guests on the program asked a very simple question. He said, why are we even reading or looking at a poll, the Washington Post poll, based on adults? Shouldn't we be looking at likely voters at this stage of the game?
Mm-hmm.
And he's exactly right. I mean, any poll that you look at based on adults, you really have to wonder, because I'll just give you an example about Texas. In 2014, the last time we had a midterm, we had almost 15 million registered voters, but only 5 showed up to vote. So 1 out of every 3 registered voters in Texas showed up to vote. So if I do a poll on adults, I'm going to be talking to a lot of people who, as you well know, because you've written about this, a lot of people who are not even going to show up to vote. But
That's right.
If I go to likely voters, I have a better chance. So at this stage of the game, it seems to me any poll, it's one of the reasons I like Rasmussen, is because they do likely voters. And that at least gives me a little bit more confidence, Bill. And their polling data has been, they're showing, I think, the generic is fairly close, Bill.
Well, you know, you've got the Rasmussen, and they claim that the generic ballot is about even. So, and they in fact, interestingly enough, did a piece today on their own website acknowledging that they were out of step with the rest of the polling industry.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see on election day who's right. I mean, either Rasmussen is going to come out of this election as the most important pollster in America if they nail it, or they're going to come out as somebody who was just wrong. I'm hoping they come out as the most important pollster in America. But let's see. They also have President Trump up by more than other polling organizations, although in the last week that number for Rasmussen was adjusted a bit downward, so that now Rasmussen and Fox agree that he's at 47%. Now, isn't it interesting also that a piece ran today pointing out that President Trump, at least one major poll, is now ahead of where President Obama was in approval at this point in his presidency. And even in the ones where he is not ahead, he is very, very close. And yet we keep on hearing that he's a historically unpopular president. Well, how can you be historically unpopular and be exactly where or ahead of where Obama was at this point in his presidency? He's historically unpopular because that's what they want to say.
Right. But the other thing that you were talking before about the news media, something else too I've noticed, it seems like everybody has their own poll and everybody promotes their own poll, which is interesting because you watch CNN, well, a new, brand new CNN poll, then you watch Fox News, a brand new Fox News poll, and at least the thing I like about Rasmussen is that he's not connected to anybody. I'm not saying he's the only one. There's others that are not connected either. But I just think I continue to say, and I've said it before in our chats, Bill, I don't know how you can take a poll in a country where nobody answers the phone. I don't know how in the world
you do
that. Because, I don't know how in the world you do that. I mean, at some point, it seems to me, I think Rasmussen uses other ways of getting information rather than just phone calls. But they're going to have to figure out some way of doing polls other than phone. Because the phone, I think, is a rather unreliable. I remember John Zogby one time saying to me that, like 30 years ago, if you were to call somebody's home, they would answer the phone and they would be happy to talk to you.
Yes.
Today, you have to talk to 30 people to get one reply. Well, that devalues the information so much, Bill.
Of course. And also, there is this whole concept of the secret Trump voters, the people who will be polled but are very reluctant to say that they're for Trump because there's a social stigma in some circles, and they don't really believe that the poll is secret. And that clearly occurred in 2016, where Trump was 10 points behind in approval on the very day he was elected.
Exactly. No, you're exactly right. Bill, a couple of stories that from this week that are not about the election but pretty important stories. This incident with Saudi Arabia and the journalist, and then U.S. and Russia, the United States apparently pulling out of a treaty with Russia. Let's talk about the journalist first. Obviously, it's a horrible story. I don't know anybody else who wouldn't think it's horrible, but I'm not exactly sure what they want President Trump to do. You know, you hear some of these people saying, well, he's coddling tyrants. Really? I don't think so. I mean, what are we supposed to do? Invade Saudi Arabia? Pull the ambassador out? I mean, that would have a lot of other consequences, too. And I think in that part of the world, if we didn't learn it with the Shah, I don't know how we're going to learn this question. In that part of the world, you're not choosing between a nice guy and a bad guy. A lot of it is in between. You got to choose the one bad guy that you can do business with, I guess, Bill.
Well, one of the things is how phony the whole subject is. Look, what happened to this man was unspeakable. I don't know anything about him, by the way. There are different narratives, as they say, in the academic world about Khashoggi. And some say that he was a noble man and a free journalist and he wanted good things. There are other narratives that are considerably less favorable that say he was really part of Saudi intelligence and that he was part of the Muslim Brotherhood. But that, putting aside for a moment, the phoniness and hypocrisy here is overwhelming. When Barack Obama met with the King of Saudi Arabia during his first term and bowed down to him, these very same people did not have the slightest objection. Now all of a sudden, oh, Saudi Arabia, it's the worst country. It is the most terrible country. How can anyone ever have dealings with it? It's all about Trump. Let's figure out a way to use this to embarrass Trump, which is their entire issue. I mean, Saudi Arabia is, you know, it's not our idea of a great nation. It's not our idea of a great government. They have been improving recently, but the guy who runs it is still ruthless. I don't know if he did this or knew about it. I suspect he did, but I can only suspect. But you're quite right. We have to proceed with great care. You know, when you look at things, go around the world and look at the tragedies that occur every day. If you take a look, for example, at South Africa, where the number of blacks killed each year runs into the thousands just in crimes alone, and nobody cares. Then you say, why are we so concerned about this one terrible incident? It is a terrible incident. And that is, it's all based on the political need to find some way to attack Donald Trump. And that is how distorted our perception of the news has become.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I keep hearing about, you know, how he likes dictators and he's coddling dictators. Well, I don't think Putin feels that way, because there's a bunch of sanctions being leveled at him. I don't think China feels that way. They're finding Trump to be a pretty tough negotiator. I don't think the guy from North Korea feels that way. I don't think Maduro in Venezuela feels that way. I don't think Castro in Cuba feels that way. In other words, I think President Trump has proven himself to be a pretty tough negotiator with many of these countries. But, as you know, this is terrible, like you said, what happened to this gentleman. But what are we supposed to do? Pull the embassy? Break diplomatic relations with Saudi Arabia? Say something that could actually make things worse? Look, I always think of Iran and the Shah. I remember when I used to hear how terrible the Shah was and how horrible he was and how horrible he was. Well, I think he turned out to be pretty good compared to what came after, Bill.
Oh, yes. I mean, I remember when the Shah was in power. And again, not a man we necessarily would admire. He was ruthless. Mm-hmm. He was probably brutal. But the fact is, you could go to airports around the world, including Israel, and find Iranian airliners. They were engaged with the world. Their mm-hmm. young generation was very, very pro-American. The people of Iran had a relative level of freedom, especially social freedom. Women did not have to go around wearing burqas. Mm-hmm. So while we don't defend the dark parts of the Shah's regime, what replaced him, the Ayatollah Khomeini, was basically a brutal theocracy, which is now the world's largest sponsor of terror. So you're absolutely right. You have to be careful not to go from the frying pan into the fire, which is that old American cliche, but one that is very, very accurate. You know, we for years put up with the fact after the Korean War, where we lost 38,000 men, we put up with the fact that South Korea was not a democracy for many years. Syngman Rhee was a kind of a dictator. He was the one who ran South Korea when we were fighting that war. But we worked with him, and we worked with the people of South Korea, and eventually, over a period of time, a democracy and a very vibrant democracy was established. Now they're a relatively close ally of the United States. It may not always work. Sometimes it doesn't work. But I think the hypocrisy here is pretty... it's pretty astounding, and you see that hypocrisy expressed in so many different areas.
Yes. Another big story from the week, Bill, is the U.S. and Russia, the U.S. threatening to pull, or I believe we will pull, out of the nuclear treaty. I'm not exactly sure what treaty this one is, but that's a big story that President Trump wants to pull out, and I think National Security Advisor Bolton apparently is behind this move, Bill.
Well, it's interesting that there are a number of fronts right now where we seem to be threatening to withdraw from agreements that are not in our favor. And I think that while we will be accused, or the Trump administration will be accused of hypernationalism, I think what the message is that's being sent is, if you want an agreement with the United States, it has to be a fair agreement, that this is not the Obama administration. Now, obviously, should the Democrats get back into power, they'll go right back to the Obama administration. In fact, it'll probably be worse. But right now, Americans know that they have a government in power that is watching out for the American interest. Many of these agreements, which look good at the time, really have become nothing more than agreements to look the other way while our enemies rearm. And we do nothing about it. We do nothing about it. And if somebody wants to do something about it, they're accused of being warmongers, supranationalistic, working on behalf of foreign powers. All the cliches are in place. But the fact is, I think that Trump, and I was reading a notation before by David Galanter about this, Trump is not seeking to be loved around the world. I think he's seeking more to be feared. You have something to be afraid of if you cross the United States. And, of course, anybody who knows anything about history knows that's the first step on the road to peace, that people will understand what will happen if they attack us and if they cross us. And that's good. That's not bad.
That's right. Bill, there's talk, getting back to our domestic politics, there's talk of Hillary Clinton. I don't know how much of this she's doing or how much of this other people are doing, but it seems like half of the Democrat Party is running for president in 2020, and Mrs.
Yes.
Clinton is one of them, Vice President Biden. I personally, this is just my own personal opinion, I don't think she is running again. I just don't. First of all, I'm not sure she really has the energy to do it. But anyway, I don't think she's going to run. But I do believe Vice President Biden looks to me more and more like he's going to be running, Bill. And he might be an interesting candidate. I know that we joke about him, but he may very well be the compromise candidate for the Democrats in 2020, Bill.
Well, he might be. And, you know, if he is, they'll first have to remind him there's an election.
That's right.
And then they'll, you know, I mean, I don't think there ought to be an age limit to people who can run for office, but it is a killing job. And I think he'll be in his late 70s by then, which means essentially a one-term president, which immediately limits his political power. And I don't know what he has to offer. I mean, this is a man who's, you know, by most accounts, a decent man. But when it comes to foreign policy, this is a man who has been wrong on every single major issue of our time. He is very much an appeaser, and I don't think he's ever really accomplished anything. But, you know, if he runs, he'll be running against Trump. And, you know, there will be a contrast between, you know, Mr. Decency and Mr. Indecency. The trouble is Mr. Decency never did anything. Whereas Mr.
Right, exactly.
Indecency is accomplishing a great deal. I think that, you know, I can't see Biden being elected, but you just never know. You have this influx of young voters who are basically told you must vote Democratic because Republicans are just a bad bunch. And they've come to believe this.
Right.
They really
have. I
hope
they don't turn out, which is, of course, always a problem for,
well,
for young
yes,
voters. They don't always turn out, which is... which is what our best hope here is that many of these people vote like they have in the past. Bill, looking at next week, I'm sure many of these issues are still going to be on the table next week, but we'll be a week closer to the election. By next Sunday when we chat, we'll have probably some preliminary information about early voting in many places.
Yes.
Texas is one of them. I will at least give you my own impression. The last time, I mean, back in 2016, I mean, there were lines on early voting. I mean, you would have thought the election was that day, Bill,
yes.
because of the turnout. So,
well, of course, the question is, who are those people?
Who turns out? That's right.
Yeah.
But we'll know more next week. But what other stories will you be following this coming week, Bill? And I know that the young woman in the Bronx will probably get your attention with a couple of other statements. But what else will you be looking at?
Well, I watch for her every day because I want to know what the
yes.
latest wisdom is. Well, certainly the migrant march. This is a big story, and it's a big story politically more than it is socially because it is so, as we said, so obviously timed to coincide with our election. That will be a big story. Saudi Arabia will continue to be a big story. But it's going to be election. We're coming up on Tuesday to the two-week mark. Now, I point out that 2 weeks in politics is three lifetimes. So anything can happen in these next 2 weeks. You know, if we'll be talking next Sunday, just before the 1 week point, that's when the real panic will be underway. It's starting now, and we will get the last minute stuff. But I don't think we're really going to know until election night who's really going to win in this election year. It's such a strange election year. And you can be certain. The networks, by the way, it's interesting, are treating this like a presidential election. They're pulling out all stops. And, of course, the reason they are is they're hoping for a Democratic victory that they can sit there and celebrate because they were denied that celebration 2 years ago when they were on television literally weeping, some of them, about the fact that Donald Trump was elected. So they're treating this as being very important. So no matter what happens, if the Democrats pick up one seat in the House, you will see somebody on CNN saying, this is a landslide. It is a wave election. It is a complete repudiation of Donald Trump and Ronald Reagan and even George Washington. This is the most important election in our history. And, of course, you know, should they pick up the House, that it will, same thing, a repudiation. Should the Democrats pick up both houses in Congress, and it is possible, that you're going to see people being carried off the sets of news programs in euphoria. They need to be treated at a hospital.
That's right.
But I don't think necessarily that will happen. If it's a split decision, well, it'll be a split decision. Again, we have to think and trust our own eyes, our own ears, and not listen to so much to the news people.
Well, and that's right, and that's why I'm hoping next week, as I vote here in Texas, I often drive by, you know, some of the places that people are voting, and we'll see the lines, we'll see some numbers. They usually give us some numbers, not necessarily who they're voting for, but at least, you know, what parts of the state are having a large turnout. So we'll have a sense next week of what's happening, and at least we'll, like you say, you know, we can tell you what my eyes are seeing here in Texas. But Bill, as always, thank you for your time. Thank you for the time, and I wish they're not your Dodgers anymore, but I guess you're somewhat still connected to them. But the Dodgers are playing the Red Sox in the World Series, and it should be a great series. They're both very good teams. And
yes,
it should be an exciting series. So I just hope the games don't last 4 hours. That's my hope.
I will read the reports after the games. The Dodgers are expatriates. They used to be in Brooklyn, well, we don't really regard them as the Dodgers. They kept the name, but they lost the religion.
Right. Well, have you noticed that it's the same they wear the same uniform that
absolutely
they did in Brooklyn?
Absolutely.
Isn't that great?
The same. Yes, they stole that too. They didn't even leave the garment industry here.
That's right. The only difference, of course, is the cap. You know, instead of
that's
the
right.
B, it's L.A., but I guess that was to be expected. But it's the same uniform, which I think it's kind of cool. I like tradition in sports uniforms. I think it's kind of cool to wear the same uniform.
Well, yes.
Like
well,
the Yankees and the Red Sox and all
Yankees
that same
do.
Uniforms
yeah,
as
the,
always.
The Yankees are in pinstripes.
Right.
Best team money
that's right,
can buy.
That's right. Well, Bill, thank you so much as always. Have a wonderful evening. Thank you for your time, and keep up the great work at Urgent Agenda. It's always a lot of fun to see it every day.
It's a pleasure to talk to you, and we'll talk again next week.
All right. Thank you so much. Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. We always chat with Bill on Sundays. Have a lot of fun, very informative, and as I like to say every Sunday, check out Urgent Agenda. I think you're going to enjoy it a great deal. Very informative. It's super informative on this and many of the issues of the day. Well, we didn't talk about the weather, but it's an absolutely beautiful day here in Texas. Just lovely, beautiful weather here in North Texas. Good night, everybody. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas.